I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Ayaan Hirsi Ali joins me now. Her new book, Heretic, Why Islam Needs a Reformation Now, has stoked much debate in the discourse about that which she writes about in the book. Ms. Hirsi Ali says Islam is not a religion of peace. She offers up 5 points, 5 areas where Islam's doctrine can be amended, and if heeded, she claims, will end terrorism, sectarian warfare, and the repression of women and minorities that each year claim thousands of lives in the Muslim world and elsewhere. I'll get Ms. Hirsi Ali to tell us about how she would reform Islam. It's an interesting book, written with the candor and controversy that we've seen in her previous books, Infidel, Nomad, and The Caged Virgin. She is a New York Times best-selling author who is a fellow at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. She's also the founder of the AHA Foundation. She was born in Somalia, raised as a Muslim, and grew up in Africa and Saudi Arabia before seeking asylum to the Netherlands in 1992, where she later won a seat in the Dutch Parliament. Heretic is published by Knopf. Her website is at theahafoundation.org. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Toronto, Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Ms. Hirsi Ali, good morning.
Good morning to you. Good afternoon. I'm in Toronto.
Yes, that's right. Good afternoon in Toronto. Your writing, Ms. Hirsi Ali, has always provoked controversy, but where you once called on Muslims to find another faith, some have said you're taking a more conciliatory tone with this book. Are you?
I mean, to a degree, I am. I still see the same problems with Islam as I saw 4 or 5 years ago. But the difference here is I now see an emerging and very important minority that I call the reformers, the heretics of Islam, who are asking the right questions. What is it within our religion that we need to change in order to get out of this violence and this mayhem, and at the same time retain something of our tradition? And that I find that, you know, it's what makes me optimistic. I find that that group very hopeful, and I think that it's important to give them a chance to reform the religion and, you know, fight for what they believe in, which is not what Islam is now. Islam is not a religion of peace today, but it could become a religion of peace if reformed.
The New York Times review of the book suggested that the subtitle of the book could very well be How to Be a Muslim If You Must.
I think here's my intention with the book. It is to provoke a discussion on, and only with those people who agree that something needs to change, on the question of, okay, what needs to change?
Mm-hmm.
And I have these 5 proposals, but obviously different people will come up with different proposals, if any. But that's, I think, where we need to go now. I think we're stuck. You know, the whole thing, it's peace, it's not peace. We've had that, and I think empirics, the pure reality, is proving everybody who says that it's a religion of peace wrong.
Uh-huh.
And so now we're seeing that it is, it's not a religion of peace or tolerance. And there's a lot of intolerance and subjection and war and violence that's committed in the name of the religion. Now, if you agree that there is a theological underpinning for all the violence that's committed in the name of Islam, what would you do to make a difference? You know, what would you... And at the same time, and that's the challenge, how can you retain something of Islam? And at the same time, what changes would you make? These are my 5 proposals.
So let's talk about the 5 proposals, the 5 amendments that you suggest in the book. The first one has to do with the literal reading of the Quran. I mean, the Bible and the Torah, you know, make unpleasant suggestions. Devotees to jihad are taking the Quran too far. So how do you change that in a religion where this has happened since, say, the 7th century?
So my proposition is that Muslims change their attitude toward the Quran and the conduct of the Prophet Muhammad, and in particular in the period in Medina. When Muhammad founded this religion, what he was doing in Mecca is what we can describe as religion. He was inviting people to believe that there's one God and that he is the prophet, to pay alms to the poor, to fast a month a year, and go to the Hajj. All of those things and all the rituals around the holidays and marrying and funerals and all of that is, you know, what we can describe as religion. But then when he goes to Medina, he becomes a politician, he becomes a warlord or even a military general to a degree, and he becomes a legislator. And as he is legislating, he's saying that whatever, you know, all his, the new rules he's introducing, that's revealed to him in the Quran. And that is the part that I want to propose that Muslims change their attitude to. That way they don't have to give up the Quran, they don't have to give up Muhammad. It's just taking a partial attitude toward the Quran and Muhammad. And that's, everything else rests on that. All the other 4 points, Sharia, commanding right of forbidding wrong, jihad, and this investment or over-investment in life after death, it all can change, actually, if Muslims review the conduct of the Prophet Muhammad in Medina and what was supposedly revealed, which is his legislation in the Quran.
So you call in the book, you call these folks that take a literal reading of the Quran, Medina Muslims, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah,
and a Medina Muslim, in my definition, and it's a very big umbrella, is anybody who, it doesn't matter whether they use violence or not, but they share one objective, and the objective they share is that a just society is a society that is based and governed by Sharia law, divine law, that God made laws. And they reject man-made laws, or they think that man-made laws are inferior to God-made laws. And that's it's a very broad category, but that fits all under the umbrella of the Medina Muslims, because that's what Muhammad did in Medina.
And so
they want to emulate him in that sense. Now, good example. Mm-hmm. I think the most eye-catching example, obviously, is the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, but Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, but also the Muslim Brotherhood, and a whole range of Salafists or Muslims who subscribe to the Salafi period. And I emphasize, it doesn't matter whether they want to use violence, at what period they want to use violence, or whether they just want to use the means of propagation and not use violence. It doesn't matter, because the objective is the same.
And so Meccan Muslims, who are they, and how many of the faith do they number?
In my view, the category I place under, again, I'm using the term umbrellas, the Mecca Muslims, I think they're the largest number of Muslims. I think they just have to go about their daily business. They identify as Muslim. Some of them are pious, some of them are not, some of them are observant, some of them are not. They're not really interested in politics or the politicization of religion. In many ways, unfortunately, they're the largest number of victims of the Medina Muslims. And they are caught in a cognitive dissonance, because they identify themselves as Muslim. In other words, they do not question the morality of Muhammad. They do not question the truthfulness of the Quran. But they, in their behavior, they ignore large parts of Muhammad's conduct in the Quran. And these are the people we've come to call peace-loving Muslims. And they are. They are peace-loving Muslims. They want peace. They're desperate for peace. They're the ones who say, he insists that Islam is a religion of peace. And my answer to them is, listen, denial is not a refuge. You know, it's not going to solve the problems that you face. And then there's this final group, smallest umbrella, but I want to say a considerable minority. I was just reading in my news, you know, I get bulletins from different sources, that in Afghanistan, the clerics are worried because the civil rights movements and civil rights organizations in Afghanistan are challenging their authority. And these are people, you know, we are seeing more and more news bulletins about that. They're individuals, they're groups, they're rejecting various forms of Sharia. They can be women, they can be gays, they can be secular. They're fighting for something better than what they have. But instead of blaming outsiders, they're asking the right questions, which is, what is it about our religion that needs to change for us to attain what we long for most, which is peace.
So those folks are in the minority. So what do the Meccan Muslims, as you've called them, what do they need to do?
Well, the Meccan Muslims are the ones who are, again, I point out the dissonance aspect, where the reformers are trying to convince the Mecca Muslims to go along with them.
Yeah.
And the Medina Muslims are demanding and forcing and at times persuading the Mecca Muslims to go along with them. So now there's this competition for the largest number of Muslims between those who want to reform this religion and those who want to take us back to the 7th century. And the point I'm making in my book is, listen, we need to side with these reformers. However weak they are, however, some of them, we won't agree everything with the reformers, okay? We won't, our Israel politics will not be the same. The attitude to America might not be friendly, but they're asking the right questions. They're actually not even blaming outsiders, and we need to side with them the way we sided with the dissidents of communism.
Right. In the book, you talk about how Americans and others in the West downplay examples of extremism out of an abundance of cultural sensitivity. Mm-hmm. Why does that need to stop?
I think part of it is we've become very, very, very sensitive in the West, and especially we liberals, mm-hmm. to a degree that is just disturbing, where instead of, what matters is not so much the truth as how we feel about ourselves. And if I throw the charge of Islamophobia or racist at you, then most people tend to back off. And then we have a movement, and it's not one movement, but in this Islamic movement, is taking advantage of that. They haven't caused that self-censorship, but they're taking advantage of it. And then what we have also done is our leadership, political leaders, media leaders, we're surrounding ourselves with people who are not solving problems and not clarifying problems, but they're telling us what we want to hear. I want to hear that Islam is a religion of peace. I want to think and live in the comfort that nobody is threatening me and that, it's a handful of crazy people who hijacked Islam. But is that the truth? Are there any facts to support that? And if it's the opposite, what do I do? What do I do with that fact? And our leaders should surround themselves with people who show them these facts as clearly as possible so that they can base their decision-making on actual facts, not on fantasy. And fantasies like Islam is a religion of peace.
You also write in the book about how the left in America especially frustrates you with its response to the oppressed, especially Muslim women.
Yeah, I do, because the left as a movement was all about standing up for the people who are underprivileged and who are weak. And we have a world religion, it's the second largest religion on the planet. And in the name of that religion, women are subjugated. They're second-class citizens. Some of them have been turned into slaves. And there's just so much hatred for women that's put in practice, and so much violence against women in the name of Islam. But instead of standing with the brave women who fight for their rights, we're standing with the clerics who are saying Islam is a religion of peace. What about the gay movement? We're now at a place in the U.S., United States of America, where we're saying, we have to give gay people the same rights as we do. If they want to get married, then we should recognize those marriages. And I'm a firm believer in that. But what about Muslim gays who are being killed? And it's not just Muslim gays. Just to be homosexual is an offense if you believe that Sharia law is the right moral framework. What about Jews? Antisemitism has been revived in the name of Islam to a degree that 10 years, 20 years ago was unthinkable. 1945, after the defeat of National Socialism, we all stood there solemnly saying, never again, mm-hmm. and now it's happening. Jews are feeling so uncomfortable in Europe because of radical Islam that they are considering moving away from Europe to Israel or America or elsewhere. That's a shame. And it's all in the liberal era. Yeah. In the era of progressives, and that's just crazy.
What do you make of people in the West who get radicalized into Islam? And we hear the argument that they get radicalized because of poverty and marginalization. I mean, is that the reason, you think?
I don't think that's the reason. I think there are a lot of poor people and a lot of marginalized people who are not joining jihad or inventing bad ideas to kill other people in order to get improve their lives. The American story, the American narrative was you come here poor and underprivileged and you get an opportunity to work hard and get out of poverty and make, when you have your children and they have their children, life gets steadily better. Now, you can have all kinds of economic discussions or philosophical discussions about that and whether that American dream is alive or not, but you cannot also ignore that parallel with that is this narrative that Islam, Sharia law, jihad, that is the answer to the problems we face as human beings. And that's being advanced in schools, in colleges, in neighborhoods, in Islamic centers, in all sorts of channels of socialization. And the more we turn away from that, the more we ignore it, the more we are, you know, confronted with these grim facts of young people acting on what they believe. And if what they believe is jihad and they act on it, then we have terrorism and anti-terrorism laws and wars. And I don't know how much of this has to happen before we wake up and think, listen, this is an ideology that we need to fight in the battlefield of ideas.
And winning the battle of ideas, I mean, what's the best way, do you think, that we can do in the West in that effort?
I think it is to expose to children, to young impressionable minds, even though they grow up in Muslim households, that if you follow the example of the Prophet Muhammad, particularly in Medina and particularly in his, you know, his philosophy of how society ought to govern itself, that the outcome is nasty, it's poor, it's tragic, and it's destructive, and that there's a better idea. It's not perfect, but the ideas of liberalism, of free markets, and free political societies are far more powerful, in my view, and far superior to the idea of Sharia and jihad.
And so how does the future look for you 5-10 years hence? I mean, do you think we'll see more of the same like we saw in Garland, Texas last week, Charlie Hebdo, or the killings in Ottawa that we saw in the fall?
Well, what we now know and what our security authorities know is that there are attempts and plots on a daily, weekly basis, and that this is on the rise instead of falling. In other words, the strategy of denying that this has to do with Islam, the strategy of investing in the wrong partners, Muslim Brotherhood types as our advisors in order to decrease this violence, is not working. And so we have to explore new ways of persuading young people whom some of them are born here, many of them are born here, and many of them have become naturalized citizens. So we're talking about our citizens, Canadian citizens, American citizens, British citizens, other European citizens, Australian citizens. What is it that we can do to persuade them to reject the ideology of the Islamic State? And my answer is that if we help them review these five key points, I call them the five amendments, mm-hmm. then you know, we have a much better chance. We have a much better chance of dissuading them from joining the jihad movement.
No. In the course of publicizing this book, a number of reviews have come out already. I mean, you have detractors. There's a lot of criticism about the thesis of this book. Everything from that you're demonizing Muslims, or that your own secularism has hampered your understanding of the Reformation. There was also one critic who said that you failed to assimilate in the United States. I mean, so how do you win the battle for ideas if you're not winning the argument in the West, say?
Well, these are people who are members of the Honor Brigade. This is what they would say to a book like Heretic without reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And they say to all other heretics of Islam, anybody within Islam who starts to ask questions, let alone someone like me who steps out altogether, that's what they say. You know, instead of addressing the message, you try and character assassinate the messenger. But I'm also getting emails and followers on Twitter from within Islam who are supporters and who are excited about the prospect of change and who understand the threat. And I'm doing it for those guys and girls. I quote at length in the book from a woman who wrote an open letter to the actor Ben Affleck after he had a discussion on the Bill Maher show with Nicholas Kristof and Sam Harris. And Sam Harris is a very dear friend and supporter. And her letter pretty much says to Ben Affleck, I understand that you are, you know, you want to support us as Muslims, but really what would be supportive would be to have this conversation about how to change our religion. And even having the conversation isn't allowed. You can't even start it. So I think that we should give more and bigger platforms to women like her instead of these, you know, I don't know, Asra Nomani calls them the Honor Brigade, members of the Honor Brigade, but they're people who are really a part of the problem.
What have you made of the reception to the book in Canada? I mean, and what do you make of the conversation that we're having in the discourse about Islam in this country?
I think what Canada can say is, you know, Canada has welcomed and has been welcoming Muslim immigrants from all over the world for decades. Muslim immigrants have set up businesses here, have enjoyed everything that a prosperous free society has to offer. So for Canadians to be talked into white guilt, I mean, you really want to be you know, masochistic. I don't know. I think the facts prove that living in Canada is so much more comfortable and so much better than joining the Islamic State. And there was one Canadian who was interviewed. I think it was on BBC's Panorama, one of the British media sources. And he said, I lived and led a wonderful, comfortable life in Canada, but I joined the Islamic State out of conviction. That's what I want to do. I know it's uncomfortable. I know it's hardship, but I did it because I'm convinced it's the right thing. And I think we need to listen to young people like that and engage them in a debate where we say, well, let's see, how is that better? And sooner or later, we're going to arrive at the fact that 100% of Muslims are raised to believe that the Quran is a superior document and that we need to live by its dictates, and that the Prophet Muhammad was the perfect moral human being. And sooner or later, we have to review his morality. And it may not happen in my lifetime, but I am confident it's going to happen.
This is such an interesting and engaging book. It's been good talking to you today. Thanks for this.
Thank you very much.
The book is called Heretic, Why Islam Needs a Reformation Now. It's published by Knopf. Its author, Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Join me on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.